I'm Piper.
And I'm Anne.
Welcome to Off the Tracks podcast, where we explore what it means to do law differently.
Today we are joined by Kay Booth as part of our Going Solo series about lawyers who have made the leap and opened their own law firm. After starting her family law practice at a large firm, Kay opened her own firm, Empathy and Advocacy Family Lawyers, in 2021. Empathy and Advocacy Family Lawyers operates solely with accessible, flat-rate pricing for family law clients. Since first opening her practice, Kay has now brought on an associate, and together they work to provide counsel for individuals who cannot afford an hourly rate but do not qualify for legal aid. We are so grateful to have Kay on the podcast today, and I'm so excited to hear more about how you run your podcast. Not your podcast, your practice. So we always like to start off with asking the question, how has your career evolved over time?
Well, hi, everybody. Thanks for that introduction. So I started out working in theater, actually, right out of my undergraduate. I got a degree in drama and psychology, and I worked at a local theater company for about 4 years called Theater Calgary. Just a quick shout out. Calgary has an amazing theater community. It doesn't get enough credit. I'm very proud of it. I loved working there for 4 years, but I eventually decided that I wanted to do something that had a real palpable impact on people's lives. I wanted to work one-on-one. With people to help them out. Specifically, I wanted to work in family law because I think it's an opportunity to help people in at the worst parts of their lives. And I love the drama. So shortly after I went to law school, then I had my son in the third year of law school, second semester. Then I went on to clerk at provincial court while my husband stayed at home with the baby, went straight to a family law firm, and then decided I just wanted to do things my own way. I'd always wanted to go solo. I had kind of expected to do it 5 years out after I passed the bar, but I decided to just bite the bullet and do it earlier because I was just ready to do things my own way. If I was going to make mistakes, they were going to be my mistakes, not senior counsel's mistakes. And also be able to be myself and bring my own values into my practice. And here I am now.
Hey, that's amazing. So how far into your career exactly are you? How many years of call are you when you went solo, I guess, last year in 2021?
So I'm a bit of an anomaly in that I went solo after I was a year into my career post bar call. To be honest, with COVID, I was essentially working by myself from home anyway. I felt really isolated. I couldn't ask people for help. But on the flip side of things, I was only allowed to take the clients they wanted me to take. I was only allowed to bill the way they wanted me to bill. I was getting instructions on how to run files in a way that I didn't necessarily want to. So I just decided, hey, I already feel isolated. Why not feel isolated with a little bit of control? And I just decided to bite the bullet and go out.
Yeah, I definitely can relate to some of those motivations for going solo as well. One question we had for you is there anything you would change about your journey in law?
You know what? I think this is going to be the answer a lot of people give, and probably the answer I'll give 10 years from now as well. I think this is just an ongoing lesson. To put ego aside, not worry so much about whether other people think I'm competent. Do people think I'm doing things that are prestigious enough? I really wish in law school I hadn't worried as much about that, because at the end of the day, the best job is going to be the job that suits your values and suits your lifestyle. And I feel like I'm coming to a place where I'm creating a career bit by bit that does match my values and match who I am and matches how I want my family, my life to center around my family. And it's a process, and it's always going to be a process, but I think there's so much pressure to be a lawyer in a certain way. And when I decided to go solo and not worry about whether people thought it was a good idea, whether people were going to judge me, there was a freedom there. And I wish I had come to that conclusion earlier. Then again, I bet 10 years from now, I'm going to say that again, because I'm hoping I'll just keep improving in that regard.
Yeah, I was going to say, I really resonate with what you're saying there. And when I was thinking about going solo, I didn't really tell anyone except for Piper, basically. And I didn't even really tell my parents until it was like a more solidified idea. Well, okay, I did, but you know, I kept it pretty small at the beginning. And that was one of the things that was holding me back the most, I think, in launching, was thinking, you know, what are my peers going to think? They're in the same boat as me, and they probably have the same feelings as me. And if I go solo or open up my firm, everyone's going to say, who does she think she is? Or she can't do this. What is she? I can't do it. Why is she doing it? Like, what's going on? You know? Yeah. And I think that was a big block for me. I'm sure Piper heard me talk about that a bunch.
Yeah. And that's exactly right. And there, it was a combination of being pretty junior and like the audacity of just deciding I'm just going to do it anyway. But also kind of doing something a little different. Flat rate for family law, it's still pretty unheard of in Alberta, at least, but I would venture to say Canada as well. And it's becoming a little bit bigger in the States, but still not really. The hourly model really still is the way to go. And every time I have to explain what my fees and rates are to senior lawyers, I always get this look of disbelief. And like, what are you doing, lady? Like, how can you afford to feed yourself? And to be honest, it's working. And not only is it working, I feel like because I'm in control of what I'm charging, I'm in control of my life. I'm in control of who I take on. I'm in control of the level of abuse I'm willing to take from clients, which I think is huge. And it's sort of a lesson of learning that maybe my gut actually is a good source of information and decision-making. And even though someone with more experience has done it differently, doesn't mean that's the only way to do it. And people are going to judge because it is new and different.
It's so funny. I was just thinking how, to my knowledge or to my recollection in this moment, the other family law lawyer we've had on the podcast, Leah Claussen, is from Winnipeg. Mm. And she was, I think, our third episode. And she also does some family law, and her family law is also flat rate as well. And so I think that's so cool that both family law lawyers we've had on the podcast do flat fee work. But no, I think our whole ethos here on the show is about doing law differently. And we think it's so great to hear about the different way that you interact with how you built your business and how you work with clients. And so can you tell us a little bit more about how you went about developing this flat rate model and how you've managed to find a way to make it work for both your business and your ideal client, like people who can't necessarily afford to work with someone on an hourly basis, but also don't qualify for legal aid?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of, this is such a boring answer. There's a lot of books. there's a lot of books about this emergence of the flat rate model. And the first book I read that really convinced me, it was called The Happiest Lawyer. And it's an excellent book. I think I read it in a day. It's really short. And it was just about how flat rate models changed the way this woman ran her practice. She's way less stressed. She's happier. She doesn't work as many hours as she once did. And her clients are happier too. And it really won me over. And then I kept reading more and more books about it. And I just realized that for myself, that's what I needed to do if I wanted the flexibility and control over my life that I was seeking. I was getting pretty tired of clients being really legitimately upset at the end of the month because they didn't know what their bill was going to look like. And I can relate to that. And I remember working at my old firm and realizing if I was getting a divorce, I couldn't afford myself. That doesn't seem right. And that's not to knock that way of doing things. Obviously, it's worked for a long time for a lot of people, but for myself, it was really dragging me down. So the flat rate models I had heard about, in particular from the books I read, were sort of paying an upfront lump sum that would, you know, maybe be stretched over a year, something like that. But my feeling was that family law files are so unpredictable that it made more sense for me to try to do it on a month-to-month basis. And then I started thinking, well, there's so many things we do buy on a month-to-month basis. We pay monthly for Netflix. We pay monthly for, you know, some of the apps on our phone. Could we perhaps do some kind of subscription model where we pay monthly for our lawyer? And that includes all that communication, drafting, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the way I started it out. When I brought my my best friend on to also work with me, Alex Carter, he suggested that perhaps I could lower that monthly rate and then charge additional flat rates for court appearances. So it was sort of like an a la carte menu. And you knew that if we were going to go to trial, it was going to be this on top of the monthly fee that includes all that communication. So what that's done is my clients are never scared to reach out to me if they have a question. So we have a pretty good relationship and pretty open relationship. And they're never feeling like, oh, I got to pay $60 to talk to Kay for 12 minutes. Or whatever the price would be. On the other hand, I didn't want this situation where the fee was so low and it covered all the court appearances. So why not go to court this month? Why not make an application that, you know, may or may not win? I didn't think that was a good way to run any kind of family law file. So that extra fee is on top of that, and it covers the extra amount of work I did for that court appearance, but also hopefully works to sort of dissuade people to go right for the litigation route. So it's worked so far. Mostly it's worked because I've kept my costs pretty low, which has been fine thus far. Eventually I am going to need a little more admin help, but right now, because I've kept that so low, I've been able to save a lot of money. I started in a co-working space, so that month-to-month cost was really low. Now I'm in a permanent office, but still that rent is pretty low. So by sort of not taking on some of the luxuries that would make it feel like a more legitimate, fancier, you know, lawyer office, lawyer business, I've been able to keep my costs low by just having the necessities and the things that keep me sane.
Yeah. Have you had to adjust? Well, I guess you did kind of say, you know, you changed the prices and added the a la carte, but especially being a junior lawyer, did you find it hard to find that sweet spot for the flat fee pricing? Because I know I struggle a lot with that and still do, in trying to find a balance between making sure that it's enough that I can live off of it, but also making sure that it makes sense for the client. So can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah. It was definitely a process. The way I basically came to the month to month fee that covers all the communication, all the drafting, all of that stuff, was I thought about what the average family lawyer's hourly rate is in Calgary. It's about $250 to $350 an hour in Calgary. And then I thought about what is the minimum amount of work I'm going to be putting into a file each month and what's sort of the average, and sort of look at that, look at the number that comes in between that. And then basically what it really came down to is, how many clients do I want to take on to live the life I want to live? What are my costs going to be? And then how much do I have to charge, taking into account how many clients I want to take on and my costs, in order to make like a reasonable income that'll keep me happy? And really that was the deciding factor at the end of the day, finding a number that I knew people wouldn't balk at, but also I knew that I could leave the office at 5 o'clock and still make an okay income. And I think I have found that sweet spot. I think as I gain experience, that sweet spot might change. But I think even being able to offer that price is important, because like I said, there are a lot of people that don't qualify for legal aid and also can't afford a lawyer. And that whole market is completely untapped and don't have a lot of opportunities to get representation. And I think it's important that they have that option.
Yes, definitely. And I also like what you were saying too about making sure that your clients aren't scared to call you. And I think that's also just really important in making sure that you are being able to do your job properly, because you can't advocate for your client properly if they're scared to tell you all of the details or call you when something comes up, if they're scared that they're going to get a massive bill at the end of the month. So I think it also kind of goes hand in hand in being able to provide like excellent advocacy when your clients aren't scared every time they're going to call you. And at least in my experience, I haven't seen any like major increase in phone calls or anything like that when you do offer services like that, compared to someone on an hourly rate basis. But speaking of keeping your expenses small, what tools have you found to be essential to your practice?
I use Clio. It's approved by the Alberta Law Society for legal practice management here. And it's excellent. I think I probably don't use it to its full capacity, but it handles all my intake. It handles my billing. It keeps track of all that contact details I need. And I love it. It's so user-friendly. They're not sponsoring me, so I won't give them too much love. But they've been great. I use Squarespace for my scheduling as well, and for getting the firm's name out there. But I have to say, a lot of the legwork for marketing that that I've had is really just the business model itself. If you have a, you know, just like any business, if you have a problem in mind that you know needs solving, then the clientele will kind of come to you. So I'm really lucky. I haven't had to do too much marketing at this point. Will that change? Maybe. I mean, my dream is to one day be able to have an articling student and, you know, mentor associates and get to that point. So the firm might grow and then I might have more needs. But right now, I've been able to keep my costs low because I don't need to advertise too much. And I've got a good referral network going. And Clio just does a lot of the legwork for me. Eventually, I think I'm going to need an assistant because I'm starting to go a little crazy. So I have to find that balance between sanity and price point at some point. And eventually it's going to get to that point.
I totally agree. I love Clio. And I am also right at that tipping point of like, okay, I could do this if I want to stay up till 1 a.m. every night and work all weekend. And I could do all the admin tasks, or I could just hire someone and it's super easy to train them because it's just like clicking a lot of buttons on Clio and it makes it really easy for someone to jump in. So Definitely. Totally hear you on that.
Okay, when you're thinking about all of the tools you've used to run your practice and the community that you've had throughout your legal career so far, how do you seek mentorship as a solo lawyer, especially because you have gone and done this really cool thing that most people don't do?
Yeah, mentorship is, it's really hard. You know, in law school, I feel like so much of law school is people just yelling at you, get a mentor. But it's not that easy. And the Law Society does offer programs in order to get into touch with mentors, but I find it really inorganic. The best mentorship relationships are the ones that, you know, kind of form from a friendship in a way, or turned into a friendship or whatever. And I do have more senior lawyers that I admire. And in fact, I'm lucky to have clerked at the provincial court, and I have, you know, I was able to meet some mentors through that as well. But really what I think it comes down to is, I don't think you necessarily need to go through a Law Society mentorship program in order to meet someone cool. Just find someone that you've seen in court that you think seems really approachable, seems to be doing cool stuff, is reasonable, practices in a way that aligns with your values, and then just reach out to them and grab coffee. And I know that they always said that in law school, just ask them out for coffee. And it's the scariest thing. But I think I've learned I have to be okay looking like I don't know everything, because nobody knows everything, and it's okay to ask for help. That said, I also really like, I guess, lateral mentorship. You know, engage with other juniors, because they're the ones you're going to feel the most comfortable asking those questions that you think maybe you should already know the answer to, and be okay looking maybe a little, I don't want to say dumb, but like, essentially that's what I say when I talk to other juniors. I'm going to ask you this question because, and I might look dumb, but it's okay, because we're all going to look dumb together and help each other through this. So early on, I got a sort of a messaging group of other junior family lawyers together, so we could all vent with each other and also ask each other questions. And I think that's super important.
Yeah, I think that is an excellent idea. I have a few different junior lawyers that I can turn to as well when I need assistance. And that happened to me just today, where I was so nervous that I was just really dumb about this thing and kept messaging other juniors. And eventually I did have to go to a senior lawyer, and they gave me one answer. And then 2 seconds later, we're like, actually, never mind. I don't know if I was correct the first time. And it just, it was like a reminder that we are not expected to know everything, and that it's not dumb to reach out. And it probably would have been worse if I just tried to do it on my own. And it's okay to not know everything, because no one knows everything, no matter how senior you are. But it is always nice to have juniors to initially bounce that idea off of, just when you're like, okay, maybe another junior knows this answer and it's just I'm overthinking it, or do I actually need to go to a senior lawyer and talk this out?
Yeah, and on the flip side of that, I think it's important, at least for me, I have a lot of trouble with imposter syndrome, and I have a lot of trouble trusting my gut, and I've had to learn the hard way that that's not going to work if I'm going to work on my own. And there'll be times when I have senior counsel telling me how to do my job, and I've had to learn to remember what my values are and remember that I actually do understand the law as well, and that I might actually be right. And that does happen sometimes. And senior counsel don't always know the answer, and they don't always practice in a way that I would want to practice. And that's okay too. Mentorship is important. Asking other people for help is important, but also learning that, like, maybe you do know what you're doing is important too. They always say for lawyers, you should always assume you don't know what you're doing and then double and triple check and all that. But honestly, I don't know if that's the best mental health strategy either. And at some point you do have to trust yourself.
I love that. I had trust your gut as like a little saying on my iPhone all last year. I've changed it up this year, but that was my saying for last year. And I really love that, because it is, as a solo, you do kind of just have to trust your gut sometimes and just go with what you know. And so another question we had for you was, How do you take care of your mental health? And as a solo, have you found health insurance that adequately supports you?
Yeah, I haven't found health insurance. It's on the list. And, you know, in terms of the mental health, I was thinking about this question, and I had all this big list of all the things you should do to look after mental health. But I realized that, like, I'm working on it. This job is hard, especially, well, I'm not going to say especially because I haven't practiced in other areas. I've practiced exclusively in family law. But a lot of my clients aren't happy people. And the party on the other side isn't really happy either. And it's really easy to take that on, especially if you're someone who's sensitive. And I think sensitivity is an underrated skill as a lawyer. So mental health is really tough. And all I can say is it's going to be a moving target, but setting boundaries is going to be the thing that's going to help me personally the most. I have a compulsive need to check my inbox when I'm not at the office. I've had to tell myself no just once a night. And when you're with your family, you're with your family. Just setting boundaries like that and learning to essentially parent myself, because I am my own boss. And so I kind of have to boss myself around a little bit and say, these are the boundaries. This is how you're going to run your practice. And it's just a job at the end of the day. And remember that busyness culture that seems to exist in law, you can circumvent that. Busyness does not have to be a point of pride.
No, absolutely. And so on that note of not glorifying busyness, can you tell us, Kay, if you could just change one or two things about the legal profession, what would that be?
So many things. You know, I initially named my practice Empathy Law. When my friend Alex came on, we changed it to Empathy and Advocacy because he's a little less airy-fairy than I am. But all along my time in the legal world, I've had people tell me, you know, you're too nice, you're too soft, you're too sensitive. And I've had to learn that being nice, being kind is my superpower. Sometimes it gets in my way as well. And I've had to learn to be assertive where I need to be. But I really wish this legal profession would value niceness and empathy and sensitivity a little more. I find in family law, it's so much about emotions. And often you can't really reach a settlement until you talk your client or the other party through their emotions first. And yet there seems to be this overarching feeling from family lawyers that clients are the enemy. And I get it. Sometimes it can be really tough, but I do wish there was a little more recognition that our clients are people, we're people, the judge is a person, the lawyer on the other side is a person, and we're all just trying to get through this. And being sensitive isn't a weakness, it is a strength. And that doesn't mean it's the only way to practice law, but it's okay to show your emotion as a lawyer. Don't let it control you, but it can be your superpower. And I think that goes into that culture of busyness as well. It shouldn't be a competition to see who has the worst mental health and who's the most frazzled. Let's all just look after each other. We're all kind of in this together.
That is an excellent takeaway, Kay, and I really appreciate you sharing that, especially as someone who is a very sensitive soul when it comes to litigation and advocacy. So I really appreciate hearing I'm not alone. So what is one of your favorite or proudest memories or moments from your career?
I have a lot. It's hard to pick one, but I think a recent one that I think affirmed why it was a good choice to go out on my own is I had a client come to me And she was in a really tough situation. She was living in a shelter. She had the most beautiful little baby, and I'm a sucker for babies. And she just frankly couldn't afford a lawyer or even legal aid. And she asked me if I'd take on her case. And I said, yes. And she asked me how much. I don't have a lot of money, but I'll scrape it aside. And I just decided in that moment, you know, don't worry about it. I'm going to take you on pro bono. And after I explained to her what pro bono meant, she just started crying and, you know, gave me this big hug. And I would not have been able to do that at my previous firm. And it felt really, really good. And it felt like I knew for sure I was helping someone that day. And we ended up going to trial and she won. And, you know, I didn't get a big paycheck at the end of the day, but she baked me a cake and wrote "Thank you, Kay" on the cake. And it was just the biggest win for me, because I knew I had made a difference in someone's life that day. And I think as lawyers, those should be the wins that we're looking for. So that felt really important to me and special to me, and affirmed that I was doing the right thing.
Kate, that is such a beautiful and powerful story at the same time. And I think, like how you were saying that empathy and advocacy can coexist, I think like beauty and power can also coexist. And there's so much of all of those things in the story you just told us. So that's amazing. And I think there have been so many crucial and unique takeaways from everything you've shared with us today. Erin and I love to end the podcast with the same question every time. And we love to learn from our guests. What is something new that you've learned recently?
Something I've learned recently, and keep in mind that I'm a junior, so if you've got more years on me, bear with me here. But I spoke a little bit about how I'm kind of a, you know, nice, easygoing person, really want to get along with everybody. On the flip side of that, I've learned that just because I'm a nice person and I go out of my way to be kind to people, opposing counsel isn't always going to give me that same courtesy. And I've learned that I can't out nice people into working with me. There are some personalities that actually you do have to meet back with assertiveness. So I've learned that sometimes I need to be as assertive as someone else is aggressive. And opposing counsel doesn't have to like me. And that's, I think that's an obvious one to most people, but it was a lesson for me that sometimes the best way to serve my client, even though being nice and being kind and being open is my superpower, and it has gotten me through the hard shells of some opposing counsel and gotten them to my side. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I need to put on, my big girl pants and push back. And that's okay. And not everyone's going to be nice. That's been a big lesson for me, especially the last couple of weeks. I've been dealing with a particularly difficult file, and it took me forever to realize that opposing counsel wasn't going to like me, no matter how charming and nice I was, and that it was okay.
That is definitely a hard thing to deal with when you're, at least like me, a people pleaser, and you really want everyone to like you and get along. And yeah, sometimes opposing counsel is just not something you're going to win over. And so you do kind of have to meet them where they're at sometimes.
And frankly, I have been enculturated as a woman to try to get along with everybody. And a big source of my practice and why I practice is being a mother. And I love working with mothers. I almost work exclusively with mothers, not even intentionally. It's just, I guess, the energy I'm putting out there. And so I see myself as quite nurturing, but there's another side to mothers, and that's the guilting mother that's really going to get their point across and let you know that you're not doing the right thing. And that side has come out lately with opposing counsel, and it has its place.
The mama bear.
Sorry?
Is that the mama bear?
Sometimes. Yes. Sometimes the mama bear comes out. Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you so much for coming on our show and spending some time with us today, Kay. We have both learned so much, and we know our listeners will too. To stay up to date with the podcast, follow us on Instagram at Off the Tracks Podcast, and stay tuned for our next episode next Tuesday.